And we're kind of probably wrapping up reproductive technologies today. And so where we had left off, we had kind of talked quite a bit about the details of IVF, right? And so we've talked kind of as a theme throughout. We have basically we have creation where everything was good. We have our sin-cursed world where we're dealing with the effects of sin. And then we're asking ourselves, how does the technology help or hinder, right, the relationship between those two? And one of the first things we talked about was just that, and regardless of whether it's at the creation or now in the sin-cursed world or even using technology, in all those examples, right, we still have the same model that children are to be brought in, right? A man and woman are united in marriage. Okay? There's a one flesh. And the result of that, right, can often be children. Okay? And so when that pattern doesn't carry out, we've been looking at how do we address, right? What can we do? What should we not do? And so I think last time where we ended, we were on pages six through eight. There was nine different concerns.
What's that? A big margin of error.
What's that?
Page big margin of error.
Six, seven, eight.
Six through eight.
Well, the crack, we're looking at morality issues, and number one is at the bottom of page six. Two, three, four are on page seven. Five, six, seven, eight, and nine are on eight. And as we had talked about the process from beginning to end, we said these are some concerns. Okay, some concerns. And so let's jump over here. What were some of the biggest concerns that you remember about IVF in terms of whether or not it's a viable option for Christians? What's that?
The unused embryos.
Unused embryos, right? So we have fate of the embryos. So, and we could maybe divide them, right? As to what ideally the embryos would be, right, result in a live birth, right, pregnancy. What were some other of the options that the embryos could have?
Freezing.
And so freezing was kind of like, right, we weren't really sure, right, where it would go, but let me put it over here. Because once they're frozen, the question is, what do we do? Remember we talked about how there was maybe a million frozen embryos. Yeah.
I guess you could say the amount.
Say what?
The amount.
Mm-hmm. The amount.
Like how much is like already frozen from others.
Okay. So there was a concern on like just the amount. What were some of the uses of the embryos that we said would be not an ethical option?
Research.
Yeah, research. Where they just kind of splice them open and. Anything else?
I think using them for maybe other people, like giving embryos out without like consent or something.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah, let's see. I don't know what we would call that. There was the idea we could talk about briefly that the current legal situation is that embryos are viewed as property.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so that's a different view than the Christian worldview that they are children of the parents.
Mm-hmm.
And how embryos can be transferred legally, kind of like with written consent, and not viewed in the same light as adoption.
Mm-hmm.
We also just have disposal.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They don't do anything, they allow them to cease to exist. Was there anything else? We had live birth, freezing them. Was one of the more, becoming a little bit more common? Well, we call them adoptions, right?
Yeah.
A snowflake, right?
Yeah.
So there are some couples who are choosing to, there's kind of a bank that's made for couples who want to, let's say they have a conviction that they don't want to dispose of or do research on these frozen embryos, but maybe they're unable or unwilling to, maybe they have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, they've had several of them as children, they have some left, they can donate them to a bank where other couples can adopt and have those frozen embryos implanted. What do we think? Is that an ethical option? Yeah, yeah, that's a good one. Okay, so this is, and that kind of dealt with what to do, right, afterwards. Because, and why are there so many frozen embryos? You remember what the key reason why? Why does this process result in some of these extra?
Because it takes a while to get the fertilized egg.
Yeah, and so that kind of brought up the idea of
it's kind of half a lot.
It can, right? This idea of risk, right? That usually there maybe are 10 to 12 eggs that are taken out, and at each stage there's a little bit of attrition. So not all the eggs are mature. So maybe there's 12. 10 of those they attempt to fertilize. Maybe 8 of those get fertilized. Out of those 8, maybe 6 survive until implantation. And out of those 6, maybe 3 actually implant. So that there's this each stage along the way. And so that was a key issue. And so that was a big, right? The number of eggs, both harvested. And and so you can see there's lots of danger. If you were going to argue, let's say you had a couple that was pursuing IVF, and you were counseling them as to all these concerns, is there any way or things that you could change in here that would make you think that it could be a potential, it could be an ethical choice to pursue? Say you're looking at a couple that's, they've been trying to have children, and they've had either no pregnancies or their pregnancies have all ended in miscarriage. Are there any things about this that could be changed, or is it totally off limits? What do we think? If you look at the concerns, look at these concerns 1 through 9, right? So we talked about, does IVF allow people to play God? And we kind of talked about that in the previous section. Does it violate God's design for parenthood? So we talked about that in terms of where are the mother and the father in the picture. So number 3, really kind of A, B, and C, talks about this idea of the risk. So it says, some doctors claim that only 30% of natural fertilizations result in a baby. And that was kind of a statistic that we talked about a little bit. You guys remember that, like what percent over here? I think right now, the estimate of, I came up with two estimates. They say of known pregnancies, there's 10 to 25% result in miscarriage. And then total, they say it could be up to 40. They say that the vast majority happen in the first 4 or 5 weeks of maybe there's a fertilized egg, but before maybe the mother even knows that she's pregnant, it miscarries. And so once it makes it past that 5 to 7 weeks, the percent drastically drops. And so those first few weeks are kind of crucial. Yes, sir.
I think if we're in a counseling situation,
yeah.
One, we want to recognize that it's like the heartfelt desire to have children is a good thing. Mm-hmm. That's not a bad thing. But if you've been trying and trying, mm-hmm. and you can't,
mm-hmm.
I think maybe one of the questions that might be worth asking is, have you considered adoption?
Mm-hmm.
We know, obviously, again, it's not necessarily the same in the sense that we get it. Like, there's that desire to have children,
mm-hmm.
right? And we want to recognize that difference.
Mm-hmm.
But at that same time, that has not currently been in the cards for you.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than attempting something that has a great, great level of risk, and again, I don't know what percent. It's
sure.
It's fine.
Sure.
But definitely something that does carry a lot of risk.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than trying that, maybe is there the possibility that you could consider giving
mm-hmm.
a home to children
yeah.
who are here right now who do need that help?
Yeah.
I'm not saying everybody should always adopt.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
Obviously, there's a time and a place, but
mm-hmm.
but I think it's a worthwhile question to
yeah.
ask.
Absolutely.
And if they're not willing to adopt, I think then we need to ask why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when we get to this idea, if right, we'll talk about call it the infertile,
right? The options. Adoption's definitely one of those. We're gonna kind of look at that. That's kind of how we're gonna be wrapping up too. Is talking about how would you counsel someone who's, regardless of all the technologies, they're unable to do so. Or other thoughts.
I think it's hard to say unless you're in the shoes of the people that are going through it. I think a lot of the cases that I've known that have used IVF are low success rate, but
mm-hmm.
a lot of times years later they had a pregnancy and it was a success,
mm-hmm.
and God gave that to them. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's a good thing, I think, and it allows them to have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I don't know, God teaches us through trials, and that's part of a trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I wouldn't say it was a bad thing if they kept trying.
Yeah. And I think, too, I think this part is a little bit subjective. I do want to make sure that we understand there's a clear line in this area of number of eggs harvested and fertilized, is that for a Christian couple, you would want to be very clear if you're going to engage in IVF, that you're working with a doctor and they're clear that you're not going to produce more fertilized eggs than you're willing to deliver,
mm-hmm.
right? That's a key, clear kind of line of distinction. And so that could be extremely expensive, right? So it becomes are you willing to go through this process? Because many times the results are fairly low, and that's for producing, you know, as many as possible. And so it greatly does reduce your odds, but that would be kind of a big, clear moral distinction to say, we only want to fertilize as many eggs as we're willing to deliver and to have as our children provide for.
You have an ethical responsibility for those eggs. I mean,
yeah,
they're
children.
Yeah, 100%.
Not only to raise them, but to care for them from conception, fertilization, throughout the pregnancy, to not put them at great risk, those type of things. And so that may or may not change is going forward in terms of whether or not the technology becomes more and more, quote unquote, safe. But if you... It was interesting. I was talking to see the Terrells here this week, but they had a friend that he said, I don't know if they would. They were talking about this, that they would choose the same again. But they went through IVF and it was very successful in the sense that they had 7 that were fertilized,
mm-hmm.
and they've had 1 at a time, and they said they just had the 4th one not long ago. Another 3 are kind of in line, and so. They said they were committed to that Christian ethic, but it was a big challenge because there's an uncertainty of knowing, is it going to be 1 or is it going to be 10? You know, what do you do with those?
We have friends of ours, and I think the tricky part with IBS is the long term like that. Like, we have 7 fertilized eggs, so we have friends, and they had several fertilized eggs, so they froze the ones. So they had 2 successful. But then they had some left over. But they didn't really necessarily want more children because for her, IVF is not just putting in a fertilized egg. Oftentimes you have to take all these additional medications and shots which mess with your hormones so that you can carry out the pregnancy.
Yeah.
And so that was the hard part, is when she would go on these medications to give this egg the best chance of success, because it wasn't just that her body couldn't carry it,
right?
It wasn't producing the hormones along the way, which is why they couldn't conceive. It made her crazy, right? And so they didn't want to do that part again. But then they were met with this moral dilemma as believers of like, well, we have them, but I don't want to take these medications to give them the best chance. And so then it was like, are you aborting these?
Right,
and
by implanting them but not taking the...
Right, and not taking the required medication to give them the best chance of survival.
So you kind of see from a lot of these stories that it's very, very, very difficult to say that you're... I mean, it's not a clear cut, like, oh, this is a great option, right? I mean, you can say that there are times and cases where it works well and it's great and it kind of does a miracle, but it's fraught with lots of different ethical dangers.
Do you think it's wrong to donate those eggs? Like in that case where she would have to take hormones, she didn't want to do that. Would it be wrong to donate those other free eggs that are fertilized?
And I've been thinking about that. You know, a part of me, you know, thinks about this case. If it's just in terms of providing, you know, we talked about, you know, man's got to provide for his family,
right?
And so, but you talk about the, because oftentimes when you're dealing with this infertility and all these treatments, it has an impact, right? Even a very healthy pregnancy takes a toll on a woman's body. And so there's a certain consideration too for, is this going to wreak havoc on the mother's body, and is there a, we also see that with age.
Well, with the family of seven, I mean, that would be a challenge, I think, as they get closer to that, probably.
And there might be the children might have a better chance with a younger, the implantation chances are much, much higher the younger the age of the mother.
Yeah, and you have to keep in mind, I mean, this is not a procedure covered by insurance.
It's so expensive,
It's $20,000 to $30,000. So any couple that tries this clearly has the resources.
Yeah, so that's not really,
Yeah.
I think that what a threat is kind of hard, but like a donating, right? Then that opens up for people that who naturally couldn't conceive, male and male, female, female, could potentially adopt these fertilized eggs. And then there's these children of yours, biologically, in a completely different worldview. Like, there's just that potential that, like, any female, could then carry this child and raise them up.
That being said, with that, that's super true. But I also think legally you can make clear what...
Designate the fate of
designate the fate of your child.
Yeah,
I could be wrong, but as far as I recall, you can put pretty clear legal establishment to say, these are the families that I'm willing for my children, my embryos to go to.
I think
there becomes a certain point where you sign over your rights to it, like you don't have any rights to the baby anymore after.
Yeah, and as far as legal with frozen embryos, like we talked about the news story last time, they can be frozen indefinitely. There was one that were just delivered a couple years ago that had been frozen for 27, 28 years. And I think the cost ranges from $500 to about $1,000 a year to store these frozen embryos. And so we're not really sure, you know, they hypothesize it could be up to 50 years that a frozen embryo could be liable.
Yeah, I think giving up the baby for adoption, there has to be a market for people who want to adopt them. And one thing with snowflake adoption is it's expensive for the people who do adopt. And it's usually limited to people who've tried IVF and it doesn't work. The issue is the male sperm, because the woman has to be able to carry it. So, I mean, I'm looking it up, it's like 1,200 babies, snowflakes a year are adopted. So I think what people might think, I'll just give them up for adoption. Well, they're in a line with 1 million embryos. You know, and so basically, theoretically that could happen. And I think if you have a donor that you can clearly transfer it to, that would be one thing. But otherwise, I mean, you can tell yourself, I'm giving them up for adoption, but realistically the baby will never see this planet.
So that's kind of the key issue when we talk about IVF. I mean, at least for me, is that the fact that it generally creates an excess of more fertilized eggs than can be delivered or carried by the mother and father. And so
if there's a way in which you can, again, work around that, if it becomes more effective, upright. But at this point, there's a tremendous number of difficulties and disadvantages and those type of things. So that kind of brings us to, we're talking about with adoption, right? What do we do with ministering to those who are unable to have children, right? So one statistic is that 1 in 6 Americans of childbearing age will struggle with infertility. Okay. So when I was talking with Carissa about, you know, the rate of miscarriages and, like, for everyone, guys may not know this as much, but girls, if you think about friends, other women that you know, she said, well, it probably will sound high to some women and low to others, depending on their experience. For women who get pregnant very easily, this may sound higher than is realistic, and for women who have really struggled, it may seem lower than. And that varies tremendously, again, by age. And so, I want to go ahead and read. We read this maybe a week or two ago about the couple, right? Couple set to eat lunch. This is on page 9. They had spoken about infertility. I asked the wife, when you grieve over your infertility, what's your greatest loss? She didn't have to think about her answer. It's the loss of a dream, my heart's desire to have my husband's child and to raise it together. And I turned to the husband and addressed him and you. And he looked at her and back at me, and after hesitating a moment, he spoke to her gently and stroked her arm. Don't take this wrong, honey, but then he looked at me. It's the loss of my wife. She's not the same woman I married. Infertility's taking a toll on us. And so it's not just the loss of the child, but there's this additional part of anxiety. There can be depression. One statistic said that it's comparable to a woman that's suffering a terminal illness. Right? So why do you think that can be such a challenge? Right? Why is it such a difficult thing?
I think women often view it as like their responsibility to carry the child. Like, mm-hmm. This is my responsibility, this is what I can do. Mm-hmm. And then when that doesn't happen and they aren't able to, they feel like they're lesser than in some mm-hmm. way, or that they've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And so it's a new situation that you don't have to face until you face it.
Yeah.
And
never.
So it's all new territory, and it's the husband has never probably hasn't had to lead somebody through this before. Mm-hmm. And like,
yeah,
it's a lot.
Yeah.
I think just naturally too, like, we are the nurturers,
mm-hmm.
and so, like, by design, we are created to be fruitful and multiply
mm-hmm.
and to have offspring.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the man doesn't have that necessarily, like, right there, more of the provider,
mm-hmm.
not the nurturer. And so I think as women, especially when we reach a certain age, there's this just like inherent desire to have a child
mm-hmm.
and of your own. And this is what our bodies were created to do. It's one of those things that, like, creation
mm-hmm.
proclaims his glory in
mm-hmm.
that way. And so I think that that's why, because it's more of an identity for the woman as a nurturer and who God designed us to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think you expect you to be the one either.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there's just when you have a childhood dream, you just...
couldn't happen to me.
It can be really alarming and shocking. Mm-hmm. You just don't think you're going to be
mm-hmm.
one who struggles.
Mm-hmm.
So then that brings on
mm-hmm.
And for the I was just gonna say, I think for the men, and obviously, I mean, I wouldn't know, not married.
Go ahead, yes, go ahead. Hypothetically.
Hypothetically speaking, for the men, I think we want to help, but I don't remember who said this over there, but. They said this isn't something that the man has had to lead anyone through before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's difficult on the men's side, because we would want to help our wife. We want to accompany her, lead her, whatever, in this time. But But it's very difficult to know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In a large variety of ways. And so I think, kind of like what the husband said, it's the loss of my wife. She's not the same woman I married.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's a drag on the woman. I think it's just, it changes how you work together, and that can
mm-hmm.
be really hard to figure
mm-hmm.
out how to continue on, how to walk on together, because
mm-hmm.
you don't know how to best work with your spouse in this situation.
Yeah. I think we've kind of been talking about it in terms of it's biologically the woman is infertile. Would things be different as a challenge if it was the man, for example, that is unable, the sperm is not viable?
I think a good word for it is disappointment. somebody back here said they had a responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So you're losing your dream,
mm-hmm.
disappointed in that.
Mm-hmm.
You're disappointed. Your spouse could be disappointed. The grandparents,
mm-hmm.
potential grandparents, but the parents of the couple,
yep.
you know, they want those grandchildren.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And society just expects you to have kids
mm-hmm.
in general. And so, you know, it's just sort of not living up to other people's standards
mm-hmm.
would definitely contribute to that anxiety
yeah.
and depression.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good chance. Let's read through a couple of these scriptures. Volunteer, somebody going to get Proverbs 30:16. Chris, can you read that one in a second? And then Genesis 16:2. Nathaniel, can you get that one? And then Genesis 31:2, Ashton. And then 1 Samuel 1. Want to get 1 Samuel 1. Leo, you get that one? Okay, go ahead. That's Proverbs 30:16.
Sheol and the barren womb, earth that is never satisfied with water, and fire that never says enough.
Mm-hmm. And then Genesis 16.
So Sarai said to Abraham, "Now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid. Perhaps I will obtain children through her." And Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai.
And then Genesis 30.
Now when Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children, she became jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." Then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, Am I in the place of God, who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?
Mm-hmm. And then 1 Samuel.
Now there's a certain man from Rephaim, Zophim, from the hill country of Ephraim, and his name was
Elkanah,
and then the son of Jura.
I gave you a tough one, sorry. Just go with your best.
Just do your best. And say it confidently.
Yeah, we'll believe you.
The son of Elu, or the son of... The son of Ephraimite. He had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name was Pinah. And the Pinah had children, but Hannah had no children. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, for the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival, however, would provoke her bitterly to irritate her, because the Lord had closed her womb. It happened year after year. As often she went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her, so she wept and would not eat.
Yeah. So just four verses here, but... What do we see about like the barrenness or right? Who is responsible? See any explanations in the verses?
Yeah, the Lord prevented me.
Mm-hmm. In Genesis 16, the Lord has prevented me.
Then he says, "Am I in the place of God?"
Mm-hmm.
And the Lord closed her womb.
So there's a definite connection scripturally
yeah.
that God is sovereign over the barrenness of these women, right? And you can see a little bit, if you go back to the rest of the story, you can see it here. What was some of the effects of this infertility in their relationships? Biblically, you can see.
Bitterness and jealousy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bitterness, jealousy. Kind of discontentment, right?
Anger.
Anger. It says specifically, right?
Mm-hmm.
Discontentment.
I think in Genesis 16:2, like willingness to sin to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Not satisfied.
Yeah. You can see there's kind of a that grasping in Genesis 16, right? Perhaps I can obtain children through her. And you can see not only it was the wife, but also Jacob, right? Jacob became angry, right? You can see sense how one of the spouses can, when the other one's very discontent in the situation, that can elicit a lot of anger. Like, I can't do anything about this, in a sense. So expecting too much from your spouse. So what are some prescriptions? Here's a few of them. We hit one of them already, right? One was to consider adoption, okay? So that if you look down there at number three, consider either adoption or embryo adoption. So it does illustrate that each of us has been adopted into God's family. One interesting thing is there's a big disparity between... I can't remember the exact number, but when we were talking about abortion, I did some research on terms of couples seeking to adopt and babies that are up for adoption. I think it was something like, it was in double digits, the number of families who wanted to have adopt a baby to every baby that was adopted, at least 20 or more.
Yeah.
Couples, they want to adopt, there's no, you know, there's one adoption for every 20 or more. So there's this quote, It's there's a big shortage in a sense of live babies being born that for couples that want to adopt, but on the opposite end, there's a plentitude of frozen embryos.
Mm-hmm.
So, very different kind of economies there, I guess, in terms of.
You're saying there's more families than there is enough babies, live babies.
Yes.
So why is there full like orphanages then? Stuff like that.
So part of the thing we talked,
like
yeah, part of the thing that we talked about there was like if you think about kids that are like in the system, most of the goal of the state welfare program for kids is to try and unify the family, and so it's not that there's no one that will adopt them; it's that they haven't yet exhausted, the parents haven't given those children up; they're removed from the home because of one or both of the parents' inability to. And so the goal, if the goal of the state was to just take away kids and give them to somebody who wants to have a child, that would be a totally different scenario.
Yeah.
And so there's a shortage of babies being born where the parents just say, we want to give these up for adoption. There's a lot of kids that are in that scenario, not necessarily the parents don't want to let them go, but they're...
Not to mention there's a lot of corruption in the system.
Yes, from top to bottom, all the way around.
It's really, really bad. And especially with like the amount of money that is involved, either from like federal grants or through what people are paying to even be considered to, you know, possibly be a parent of an adopted child, there's a lot of money in it, and where there's smoke, there's fire. And so it can be really difficult because the people in charge actually feel the motivation to elongate the process and not make it smooth running, because then they lose money.
Yeah, and that is something to remember, that all the way along the way, from both the bodies to the hearts and the souls and the minds, everything is kind of cursed in the world. So there's disadvantages all along the way. I think that in the stories that we looked at, there is a sense in which the Lord both closes and opens. And so when you look at this case, you know, Sarai bore, you know, the promised child. Rachel gave birth to Joseph. Hannah bore Samuel. So these are, you know, kind of somewhat miraculous in a sense, but also at the same time, we do see that the Lord closes and the Lord can open as well.
Yeah. And I would say, my sister did a snowflake adoption and had twins. And, she loved them like they were her own. It wasn't weird at all.
Yeah.
So I think there's just this natural process that she was able to go to that just connects a mother with the child. even though it doesn't share the DNA. And I mean, you know, maybe she won't listen to this, but her snowflake adopted child is her favorite.
Oh, okay.
Easily. Yeah, Amberly, can you verify that?
So, but there's a certain sense where you're just, we want to counsel people to, right, to seek God's will for whatever that reason or time is. Whether or not it is you're barren for a time, and maybe you will eventually bear children, or if it's long term, right, that's definitely something we want to counsel people to be doing, seeking the Lord's will. Both in terms of helping them to conceive children, but also in terms of learning what is the Lord doing. He's going to do something in and through this time and this trial. Maybe in your marriage, maybe in the lives of the people around you. There's a great ministry there. And because we often the gospel is all about meeting us in terms of dealing with the sin in our life and the curse as a result of that sin. So considering medical intervention, we talked about how it could be artificial insemination, right? Mm-hmm. So that could be one of those options, embryo adoption. And then this last thing, right? Remember that although children are a blessing, they're not the greatest thing. They're not the only blessing, right? And we talked about with marriage, singleness can be a huge blessing, or even being married but childless can be serve as a huge blessing, right? Look at verse 1 Samuel 1:8 here. Mm-hmm. Then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep, and why do you not eat, and why is your heart sad? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? So, I mean, what a guy.
Like verse.
Come on, I'm not. I'm not good enough. Better than all the sons, right? You got me, right? So he's a very humble guy too. But in reality, right, not only does she have her husband, but she has the Lord, right? And so that thing, we want to make sure that both the husband and the wife equally are somewhat realizing that their contentment and their fulfillment needs to come through their relationship with the Lord first. And part of that contentment is accepting a kind of our lot in life as much as we can, knowing that although we may not be able to have the dream, I think that's part of it, is accepting whether or not your dream is God's plan for you. I think that, regardless of, you know, if for all the young ones that are not married, you and your spouse may marry, and you might have different dreams. Right? And in terms of maybe one of you only wants a couple kids, and maybe one of you wants a lot. And so almost everyone's dreams with children or with where you're going to live or how much income the Lord has for you, there's a certain sense in which we want to allow the Lord to shape those dreams and take them. It's not just the American dream, but it's what is the God's kind of plan for you. And so his sovereignty over how many children you're going to have and where he's placed you in life and those type of things. Is a big source of where we need to be trusting in him, seeking him. I'll just read the conclusion here. So reproductive technology, it can be a wonderful blessing to these longing to build a family. It should be noted that artificial insemination using a donor, as well as IVF treatments, are fraught with peril. While it's possible that AID can conceivably be permissible, it should not be the first choice for the infertile couple. Regarding IVF, the experimental nature of each procedure, the willful creation of life, as well as the risks subjected to that life, makes it morally dubious. Children are a blessing from the Lord, but we must never allow our quest to make life lead us to take life. And so, kind of in closing, I thought just to see if you guys have any discussion on a couple of things. So there is an appendix here on stem cell research, and then I also was going to... Do you guys have the appendix in yours?
Mm-hmm.
Yes? Okay. And then there's also, where did I have this? I'll read to you something that we may include in the future. And that's cloning, right? So it's kind of along with that idea, right? So there's this, have you heard of CRISPR? CRISPR technology? Anybody?
Yes.
I don't know what this is. What it stands for? Clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. Okay, you got it?
Yep.
Think of it as a molecular scissors that scientists can use to precisely cut and modify DNA. So yeah, there's a protein that's guided by a small piece of RNA to locate specific sequences in the DNA. Once it finds the right spot, it can cut the DNA at exact location. The cell then tries to repair the cut, which scientists can harness to introduce new genetic information. So here's the little history behind it, right? We talked about 78 was the first successful in vitro. And then in the 90s, this was a big issue. Does anyone know who Dolly is?
No.
Who's Dolly?
The sheep.
The cloned sheep. Yeah. First mammal cloned from an adult somatic cell using this technology. So in 98, scientists create the first cloned human embryos for the purpose of stem cell research. But none of the embryos survive long enough for further development. So in 2001 and the early 2000s, there was, you know, the U.S. bans human cloning. There was a false claim in 2004 that a human embryo had been cloned. So that resulted in the UN in 2005 adopts a declaration against human cloning. In 2012, this CRISPR technology came about. In 2015, the first human embryos are edited using the CRISPR technology in China. So that kind of brought around this designer babies type phrase, like, are we going to go in and pick specific genes for children? In 2017, scientists used this technology to successfully remove a disease-causing gene from human embryos, though none of the embryos were implanted for reproduction. So that's kind of where we're at in the 2020s. The pioneers won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, so they're definitely continuing research on the CRISPR technology. So we have still no human cloning attempts have been publicly reported, and the practice remains illegal and widely condemned. However, it continues to make significant advances in gene therapy. So there's a lot of questions that come up with, right, what are the moral dilemmas you think about there? Let's focus on, let's say that they reach a point where they're starting to say, I think we can go in and edit human genes. We see that there's a gene that causes this disease. There's a gene that causes this disease. We think we can go in and edit that to remove that gene. What do you think?
Kind of like perverting God's design in that way. By like taking out something that he's obviously like in this plan for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's a disease, whether that's a disability, whatever the case may be. I mean, he designed you in his perfect image.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see why they would want to create something to where they could cut out a specific thing to get rid of a disease or learning disability.
Okay.
So were we meant to die?
Hmm?
Were we meant to die? Were we meant to get sick?
I mean, yeah.
I think when God originally created us.
I'm confused by your question.
When God originally created us, death and sickness were not on the table, right? Death and sickness came from sin.
You guys are talking about the differences here, right?
Yeah. Death and sickness came from a sin-cursed world.
Uh-huh.
And so in the same way, those diseases that come in genetically are a matter of a sin-cursed world.
Yeah.
And so I think if, obviously this is a subject debating. I'm not saying this is the answer,
mm-hmm.
but I would argue that because sickness and disease comes from sin, then it is in no way unethical or unbiblical to use, if that ends up being a possibility, to take the genetic linkage to disease from our children. I think that that's honoring to God, in fact, because we're allowing our children to begin from a place in which they are suffering less from
mm-hmm.
sin at a starting point.
And I would also like to jump in.
Go ahead, jump in.
Like two different small points. So right now, they've recently developed a cure for type 1 diabetes where they took the cell out of a person, edited the cell, and then put it back into them. And as that cell replicates, their body can actually produce insulin itself. And that's a cure for a disease. And it is, you are toying around with creation,
mm-hmm.
but you're doing something loving to your neighbor,
mm-hmm.
and you're actually helping them, and that, I think that's a good thing. However, I wouldn't say it would be a good thing to go out of the way to change someone's eye color,
yeah,
or how their hair grows, or
yep,
specific character traits that God,
yeah,
purposely designed them to be unique and special.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Problem,
yeah,
is that once you open up to,
go ahead,
that, once you open up to that, like changing any sort of gene, you change something like a disease, it's going to change eye color, hair color,
mm-hmm,
height. You open the gateway for that, and just going to go to a plethora of things. So,
okay,
you have to be careful of that.
Dave, what are you?
Yeah, I think any experiment on human beings is wrong and immoral,
mm-hmm,
no matter the advances. I mean, the Nazis discovered some,
mm-hmm,
really cool things by experimenting,
mm-hmm,
on the Jews. And, yeah, that, I mean, to perfect cloning, what does it take? It's called trial and error.
Mm-hmm.
And experimenting on the human life, I think, that's just clearly unethical.
And one of the things with experimentation and medical treatments, what's the key difference in this case? Like, let's say you have cancer and there's an experimental drug, right? And would you like to take this? Yeah, I'm gonna take it. How, what's the difference there between here? Yeah, there's this idea of consent. And so obviously when it's an embryo, there's no consent. You're totally subjecting someone else's,
mm-hmm,
life, body,
to
that.
I think you have to be careful too when you're like going in and saying like, well, we were meant to, you know, this is pre-cursed world of playing God and elevating man's power,
mm-hmm,
of like, well, we can make it perfect and good once again,
mm-hmm,
when we don't have that capacity,
mm-hmm,
and that capability, purposefully, right? Like,
mm-hmm,
Tower of Babel did it, they wanted to reach, right? And God destroyed them. So like there's this already this warning in scripture of like elevating yourself to playing God and making things good and,
mm-hmm,
perfect again and how it was supposed to be. I don't know. I,
yeah,
think like we talked about earlier when we talked about like what qualifies a human and the disabilities and things like,
oh,
that,
uh-huh,
and how like that diversity can really enrich our,
mm-hmm,
families and our cultures by having Down syndrome and these different things,
mm-hmm,
that might otherwise be removed in the genetic gene pool if we could make it perfect in,
mm-hmm,
man's eyes, which,
mm-hmm,
is dangerous and slippery.
Yeah, and I think one thing we need to realize too is there is a difference, a distinction between the potential for getting the disease and,
mm-hmm,
and treating an existing,
mm-hmm,
disease, right? Treating a healthy person who has a gene that could trigger, that could cause. So many times, for example, we take the type 1 diabetes, people often have this genetic predisposition that could or couldn't be edited, but they may or may not develop that at a certain age, at 8 or 10 or 16, whatever happened with me or with my daughter. And so that's kind of an important distinction is, are you treating something that already exists? Is there the ability to give consent in that case?
Because even like we have friends of ours who are twin boys, and the doctors were like, oh, he has cleft palate and he's gonna have cleft feet and he's gonna need,
mm-hmm,
like all these, and he wasn't born with any of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is a sense in which we do have, sometimes we're amazed by all the things that we can do, and we maybe place a little bit too much faith in like lots of stories of people who the baby's in the womb and it's gonna have this and this. Sometimes it does, but heard a lot of stories where, again, it doesn't. We've had friends that they're advised to abort the child that's only going to live a few hours, and it's 10 years old now. You know.
It's like the quote from Jurassic Park. It's like, they're so
it all comes back to Jurassic Park.
They didn't ever stop to think if they should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting, like cloning technology has been used to clone pets. So I have a bunch of celebrities,
yep,
who clone their dogs to deal with the grief of the dog.
Genetically identical.
And they realize it's a different dog.
Pet Cemetery.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, cloning your pets, watch out. Watch out. They can't give consent either. Okay. But I think that one thing that whenever we engage in the conversation, I think that's our key thought, is that is this technology, is it something that is God that wants to use to help push back and help us to face the curse? And I realize there are times
when, like Paul, he prayed that the Lord would take the thorn in his flesh away. Right? He prayed, prayed, prayed. And God's eventual answer was, no, it's there for a purpose. Right? My power is made perfect in this weakness. So there's a certain sense in which we need to sometimes embrace the fact that the Lord wants certain things, that oftentimes suffering is the Lord's workshop in which he develops, forms us into the image of Christ. And it was a part of his plan for Christ was to suffer. And so we shouldn't just dismiss the loss of a dream or suffering as something that's definitely a part of the curse. It may be that God is using that cursed world and the cursed in your life to develop something even greater, right, for the future. So next week we're going to start on, I think it's transgender. I think so. We'll see. I don't know if you guys have heard of that. It's kind of an issue that's come up.
I think it is transgender.
Yeah. So let me pray for us as we go. Lord, we're so thankful for the ways in which we have been blessed with your provision. We're so thankful for the gift of health, for healthy bodies, and oftentimes the gift of healthy children and babies and families. And we know that this world and our bodies, that we're cursed, that every area of our life is cursed and depraved by and affected by sin. And so we put our hope and our trust in you for the ultimate, complete, and perfect deliverance, that there will be a time where you swallow up death and there will be no victory, there will be no curse, for death and sin will be done away with. And so we pray that you give us wisdom on how to live in this cursed world, trusting in you, walking in your spirit, how to counsel others, how they can trust in you and glorify you, both with their own bodies, with their marriages, and with their parenting. And help them to look to you first and foremost, seeking to glorify you in each and every decision, and to care for those who often need loving and caring adults to guard and protect our innocent and our weak and our powerless. Pray for our time this morning as we continue. Let us to worship you for your greatness and your glory. And continue to help us to learn and grow as we talk about your word and how it is instructive for all things in our life. We give you thanks in your name. Amen.